February 6th, 2023, 4:17 a.m. local time. A 7.8 magnitude earthquake levels southeast Turkey near the Syrian border.
Breaking news from Turkey tonight, where a strong earthquake struck. It was a 7.8 magnitude quake that was felt in 9 cities, as well as in Lebanon and Syria. At least 17 people have died, reported so far, but officials fear that number will rise.
That report from the day the quake struck. The death toll now is more than 50,000 people in Turkey alone, according to Turkey's Disaster and Emergency Management Authority. At least 8,000 people died in Syria, and more than 107,000 were injured in Turkey. At least 3.5 million people have been forced to leave the region, and millions who stayed are without homes. Well, on Monday of this week, at a European Union donors conference in Brussels, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan described the scale of the devastation. Almost 300,000 buildings across 11 provinces are either collapsed or in urgent need of demolition, he said. Erdogan thanked the international community for pledging more than $7 billion to rebuild.
It is really grateful for us to see the same level of solidarity shown towards us. No country on its own can combat such a high level of disaster, and the participating countries underlined it as well.
That's President Erdogan speaking via translator in Brussels earlier this week. Well, last month, just 2 days after the earthquake, as aftershocks were still shaking the ground, Erdogan made a bold promise to the Turkish people. Not only would rebuilding commence immediately, he said, the region would be rebuilt within 1 year. And within a few short weeks, the building did indeed begin. And the aftershocks continued. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Rebuilding a devastated swath of a nation ought to be a priority for any government. But can 300,000 buildings be reconstructed safely and effectively in just 1 year? Should the process take place with little to no input from the community? What is the best way to rebuild in a place where earthquakes are bound to happen again? That's what we're going to be talking about today. And we'll begin in Istanbul, Turkey, where Evren Aydoğan joins us. Immediately after the earthquake, he went to the disaster zones, and he's currently working on several recovery projects in collaborations with the United Nations Development Program. He's executive director of the nonprofit Needs Map, which uses online platforms to match those in needs with organizations who can help. Evren, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Meghna, thank you for having us.
Yes, and also today is joining us today is Jared Maslin. Malsin. He's a Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and he's based in Istanbul, and he covers Turkey and the wider region. He's reported and is reporting extensively on the earthquake and rebuilding efforts. Jared, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Evren, I'd like to start with you. Can you describe what the devastated cities in southeast Turkey actually look like right now? Because it's still hard to imagine the scale of the destruction.
Yeah, that's a very big one. Thank you, Meghna. I'll try to be very brief, actually. So the scale is huge, like far more bigger than a lot of European countries. You can imagine, like, bigger than Hungary and the others. So we're talking about 11 cities affected directly. Three of them is almost like half collapsed at least. Tens of different districts and God knows how many villages. So, like, in terms of the, like, collapsed buildings, we're talking about, again, like, more than 40,000 buildings according to the official numbers. As you have depicted in the introduction of the program, like, more than, unfortunately, 50,000 people died. We're assuming, actually, we're predicting that more than 5 million people are mobile or in some other cities like neighboring or Ankara, the capital, Istanbul, Izmir, and others. So, and other than this, like, devastating humanitarian aspect, Of course, there's a very big economic aspect. Maybe you know the region is one of the main agricultural regions of Turkey, and two main industrial zones are there as well, like in Adana and Gaziantep. They are not directly affected, but in terms of, as you can imagine, the supply chain that you have, all the supply chain links are not properly there anymore. So it is something what I call is more than a disaster. It's kind of like a need for rebuilding of all region, which is not only important for Turkey, but also very important for in terms of like the Eastern Mediterranean region as a whole.
Yes. So, well, let me just turn to Jared here to follow up with that. Jared, so Evren is describing basically the a damage zone the size of a European country, essentially, which is just massive. You reported earlier this month that, what, just 3 weeks after the initial quake, that the government, Turkish government or Turkish authorities were breaking ground on new apartment blocks in at least one town that you visited. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So the Turkish government has said, as you said, that they want to rebuild this section of the country within a year. There's obvious reasons for needing to do that. As you pointed out, there's millions of people who have been uprooted from their homes in this 200-mile-long stretch of the country. There's people sleeping in tents, sleeping in their cars, in the street, in prefab kind of container homes. So there's a huge shelter crisis and entire cities that have been emptied of people and a need to rebuild homes. The concern, though, is that they are doing this in a way that is rushed and that does not take into account the needs for urban planning, that does not include input from the local communities. And what, you know, I spoke to a lot of local officials, urban planners, architects and people like that who said that by doing this construction in this way, they might be repeating some of the mistakes that led this earthquake in February to be so deadly, in the sense of the fact that there were thousands of buildings that had poor building standards. And so that's kind of the concern right now.
Mm. Well, as you reported, many of the buildings that collapsed last month had been built after the major 1999 earthquake that killed 17,000 people there. So it was like it's deja vu in the most terrible way in Turkey right now, Jared.
Right, that's right. So Turkey's government under President Erdogan, building has been one of their signature policies. The expansion of Turkish cities, the rise of these buildings across the country has been the signature of this government and a sign of Turkey's and becoming one of the world's 20 largest economies, lifting millions of people. And what people are realizing now is that this reconstruction that took place after the 99 earthquake, which was also catastrophic, is that a lot of these buildings were not built properly. There were building standards in place that were just ignored in a lot of cases. There were construction amnesties, they were called, for buildings that violated the building codes. And a lot of those buildings just collapsed. You know, I saw it with my own eyes when I was in the south covering the earthquake in February. Enormous tower blocks that just pancaked and crushed, in some cases, hundreds of people underneath them.
Yeah.
So,
well, Evren, may I ask you, how are your fellow Turks who are living in the region, who have been displaced, who have lost their homes, how are they responding to President Erdogan's insistence that the entire region will be rebuilt within 12 months?
Actually, I am, as you can imagine, I'm not acting as a reporter, as a political scientist, and I'm not a political commenter as well, and a civil society professional. So,
well, then let me change the question and say, what do you think about that? Because you're doing as you said, the civil society work that's going to be needed to do this rebuilding.
Had a chance to understand from President Erdogan's speaking, because I'm not very much connected to the world because of the field work. He the main emphasis on the shelter for the people rather than rebuilding all the region in terms of all the infrastructure and others. So what I see is like a year is kind of a bit ambitious target because we're talking about different dynamics of different cities right now and different dynamics of different populations and the how can I say, pool of necessities, if you like. There can be some solutions within a year in terms of shelter, but I'm not sure, considering the earlier examples, because I was working in the Elazığ earthquake, İzmir earthquake that we had in 2020 and 2021. So even they were very, very smaller scale. Even there, it took like more than a year to rebuild some premises, if you like. But as I said, I'm not very much knowledgeable about the details of the plan that Mr. President announced. But the people right now concentrating on sustaining their current daily life. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether they are very much interested on the timeline about like reaching a proper housing. They're now very much interested on the sustain their life because raining started, there are storms, so tents are very much vulnerable. That's why as NeedsMap, we are trying to create three different container co-living areas in three different cities. So right now, the main concentration, as far as I know from the government side as well, to create temporary container living spaces to the people who had to leave their home or who lost their home.
So like those very urgent, immediate needs are still front and center. Well, Evren Aydoğan from Istanbul, Turkey, executive director of the nonprofit NeedsMap, an organization that uses online platforms to match those in needs with groups that can help. Evren, thank you for your work helping the Turkish people, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
Jared Malson with the Wall Street Journal in Istanbul. Stand by. We have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the Turkish government's plan to very quickly rebuild earthquake-ravaged regions in southeastern Turkey after that massive earthquake hit Turkey and Syria last month. I'm joined today by Jared Malson. He's the Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, based in Istanbul, and he's reported extensively on Turkey's rebuilding plans, including the objections of local officials about the speed at which Turkey's President Erdogan wants to rebuild the devastated region. And Jared, just before the break, Evren Aydoğan was saying something really interesting. I'm hoping you can provide some context. He said that he wasn't familiar exactly what's in the reconstruction plans. I'm wondering, in your reporting, have you found out, like, are they quite detailed plans? I mean, who is in charge of the reconstruction in the region?
Right. So in February, a couple of weeks after the earthquake, the president issued a decree in which he mandated that this reconstruction would take place within a year. And it basically takes control of the process, centralizing the entire thing out of the central government in Ankara and taking decisions out of the hands of local authorities. This is pretty unusual, but there is a logic behind this. I mean, one is that they're trying to get this done quickly. The government is under political pressure here because there's an election coming up in Turkey in May, in which the government is actually facing a pretty difficult challenge. At the same time, there's also this shelter crisis. At the same time, you also have some of these local municipalities where the local officials were actually implicated in some of the corruption that led to these buildings that were improperly built that raised the death toll. So there is a logic here. At the same time, the decree actually spells out that urban planning does not need to be done in these cases. So that, you know, one of the urban planners I talked to said that this isn't actually planning these cities. It's just picking locations for housing to be built. Uh-huh. The ministry that's in charge of this, what they'll say is, we are prioritizing safety. We're making sure that these houses are built far away from the earthquake fault lines, and that that's their primary criterion. And then the urban planners, on the other hand, will tell you, well, that's not the only factor that goes into planning an entire city.
Right.
There's lots of other considerations. Okay. Beyond just the distance from the fault line.
And then another just quick context question mm-hmm. here, Jared, because Evren said he believed that at this point in time, the focus is really on just putting up shelter for people because so many mm-hmm. don't have it. Did you get a right. sense that that's the initial focus of the reconstruction plans?
It is. I mean, that's the reason for the urgency here is mm-hmm. that you have at least 2 million people within Turkey who have been displaced. You know, again, this is an entire region, large cities, you know, cities of hundreds of thousands of people that were just emptied of people, essentially. And you can just drive around that area of the country. And it's a very surreal scene, a kind of moonscape of, you know, of broken buildings and pieces of concrete and lots of people sleeping in their cars, people who have like left the area, they're sleeping in, you know, on cruise ships and in school dormitories and you know, in hotels and with their families in other cities. And so it's a huge social location that's happened, and the government is trying to address that.
But
there's still just a lot of questions about, you know, who is going to get these homes. You know, that's an entire question of who is actually going to get one of the new housing units. And then this other huge, huge question of how are they planning these new developments? Mm. Where are they going to be located, and how are they going to be built? Which is an enormous question in terms of the safety and viability of those areas.
Right. And then also just thinking about the immediate term, there can be sort of temporary construction that's going up, but it is in a still very, very active earthquake zone where aftershocks are still yeah. happening. So there has to be a certain standard of safety for that, even that quote unquote temporary construction. So these are two really important features here about the quick centralization of the mm-hmm. reconstruction plan and then the focus on you know, getting people into homes, even if it's supposedly temporary construction. I wanted to just sort of highlight those because we've got examples from other parts of the world of the sort of unintended consequences of this process of speedy rebuilding after an earthquake. And one of the best examples comes to us from L'Aquila, Italy. It's an old mountain town about 60 miles east of Rome, very prone to seismic activity. They had a major earthquake in 1958, and then 50 years later, on April 6th, 2009, a 6.3 magnitude earthquake hit the town.
The main thing I can remember were the destruction, the dust, people screaming.
This is Angelo Jonas Imperiale. He's from L'Aquila, and he was there the very day the major earthquake struck.
That sort of thing you never expect when you see churches, buildings, and public schools that are completely collapsed. And also, both my grandmother's and my mother's homes were destroyed by the earthquake, and it damaged some 34,000 buildings, and 70,000 people were rendered homeless. 309 people died, and some 1,600 people were injured.
So very much like what's happening now in Turkey. In 2009, immediately after the earthquake in L'Aquila, the Italian government announced it would rapidly rebuild the region. The Italian government took a top-down approach, largely run by the Department of Civil Protection. And Angelo tells us the rapid construction plan was also imposed on local people without much input from them. So imposing the plan, centralizing it, and also importantly, focusing on what was thought to be temporary housing at first, all things that are going on in Turkey now. Well, Angelo is also a researcher and professor at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, where he focuses on disaster-prone communities. And in 2021, he published a paper analyzing the outcome of L'Aquila's rapid reconstruction.
this kind of solution was meant to be temporary, but actually the means of construction implied that they could be permanently used after being understood as a temporary solution. And the construction of this building was conducted without any community needs assessment, so that there were much concern about this, and especially about the location. The buildings were not close to shopping center, they created transport problems. But this quickness and speed at which these buildings have been constructed did not correspond to efficiency in construction. Actually, these buildings were poorly constructed. Of particular note was the collapsing of balconies in several buildings. In 2014, the use of the balconies in 800 apartments was banned. Other reported problems include the poor quality of construction materials, leaking pipes and water seepage, numerous deficiencies creating dangerous situations, fires due to faulty electric systems, and the improper use of flammable materials. And the cost of the project was excessive. It was reported that the total cost was some 158% more than normal market cost.
The European Union was also deeply concerned about the more than $500 million it provided to Italy for L'Aquila's reconstruction. In 2013, the European Parliament issued a report warning that much of the money was going to companies with, quote, direct or indirect ties to organized crime. Olga Capasso, Italy's national anti-mafia prosecutor at the time, said, quote, "It seems to me that among the problems related to combating organized crime, L'Aquila is one of the biggest." Angelo Imperiali says the mismanagement doomed the reconstruction efforts.
What happened in L'Aquila actually was that temporary housing drained all of the resources from the physical reconstruction of the houses. So the physical reconstruction of the buildings lagged behind. There are still around 10,000 people living in temporary housing after 14 years. The city now looks like almost rebuilt, but kind of empty of the inhabitants. Now there are a few hundred people living in the city center, and many buildings, especially cultural heritage buildings, were rebuilt, but other buildings that had no that privilege to be cultural heritage are still into ruins. While we could say that most of private homes were built following safety measures, we cannot say the same about public buildings, and this includes public schools. One of the main lessons we can learn from the L'Aquila disaster is that myth that the quickness and speed through which reconstruction is implemented correspond to efficiency, and communities are vital for the world recovery process. Only through these means you can then say that you are rebuilding the city, because otherwise you will rebuild only the buildings and these will become empty temples.
Angelo Jonas Imperiale. He's a professor at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands and a native of L'Aquila in Italy. Well, joining us now is Divya Chandrasekhar. She's an associate professor of city and metropolitan planning at the University of Utah, and her research focuses on post-disaster recovery. Professor Chandrasekhar, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
So we have two examples right now, the very active one in Turkey, and then we just heard about L'Aquila in Italy. How common is the focus is a government's focus on speed of rebuilding in other post-earthquake disasters?
It's very common. In fact, it's probably the most predominantly common narrative you hear in most disaster cases, is that the government wants to build and build quickly. It's not unfair, or it's not unreasonable, because, you know, when you're in a disaster, your first instinct is to want to go back to normalcy. Mm-hmm. And so it's not unreasonable to expect focus on speed. I think the problem is that speed is pretty much the only thing that they end up speaking about.
Right. Not only is it not unreasonable, I would say that there's a real urgency there, right? Because as Jared and Evren were describing earlier, right now in Turkey, there are literally millions and millions of people who have been displaced. So something must be done. But I wonder, in order to provide any kind of even short-term temporary relief, is it possible to do it in a different way that doesn't require, let's take the first thing that we were discussing earlier, centralization of the process, because that seems to be a commonality between the L'Aquila example and what's happening in Turkey.
Well, there are really two things we're talking about here. One is the centralization of the recovery process. That is a problem in itself. And then the other is provision of temporary shelters. When we talk about disaster recovery, especially when you talk about housing recovery, temporary housing is one of the four phases of recovery of housing. Mm-hmm. It starts from, you know, immediate shelter, you know, where you go to your, in the U.S. classically, go to a local stadium or, you know, a shelter where you can stay for maybe 24 hours, 48 hours. And then you think about where you would go from there, you know, for the next few weeks and then for the next few months and then finally to your final destination, your permanent housing. So when we as researchers talk about housing recovery, there are phases of housing recovery. So what you're talking about in terms of temporary shelters is an understood and normal part of a housing recovery. It is an expected phase. Now, the centralization, that is a bigger institutional, you know, question. Centralization means that there's a lot of decisions happening at the central level, the federal level. In this case, it could be a state level in other countries, but not at the local level. Mm-hmm. And that is relevant to all phases of housing.
Jared, I'm going to come back to you in a second here, so I appreciate you listening along. But Professor Chandrasekhar, if I can just go back to something you were saying about temporary housing, the point that really struck me that Angelo Imperiali made at the beginning of our conversation with him was that the initial housing that went up was meant to be temporary. But for whatever reason, the way it was constructed actually led it to be more of a permanent solution. So it was never really purpose-built to be a part of, the new long-term L'Aquila, and yet that is what happened. How often does that take place?
That does happen. Most other countries have a plan for permanent housing, you know, while they're providing temporary housing. So one of the things that really strikes me about the Italy example is that they either didn't have a long-term recovery plan, which would require transition or which would have a feature of transitioning from temporary to permanent, either that or the fact that the temporary shelters were really working for the local populations in some ways. So perhaps it was not the fact that the houses were great, but that they had more access to a livelihood or, you know, schooling or other services that make, well, your daily life function. And so if you have established a new normal in your temporary housing, you know, location, the incentive to go anywhere else is, well, less. So you're likely to just stay in place. Mm. There's another feature of temporary housing that's really important to understand. Temporary housing sounds temporary, but it's actually really long. For a lot of people, that could be up to 2 years, 3 years in a temporary shelter. Well, that's a long time. And you do reestablish some of those daily routines.
Right.
It could be either of those cases.
Well, from what I understand, in the case of L'Aquila, the problem was that the temporary housing didn't actually meet a lot of those needs that you were just talking about. Like, it was schools and public transit and things like that weren't as easy to come by or as they could have been in the L'Aquila situation. But Jared Malson, we've just got 30 seconds before our next break here. And Professor Chandrasekhar was making a really important point about, how well thought out are the phases of a reconstruction plan. Do you have a sense in Turkey about, you know, this is a nation that's had, unfortunately, a lot of tragic practice with earthquake reconstruction. Is the plan well thought out?
That's a great question. I mean, what the urban planners of Turkey are saying is that this is not a plan. It is not a well thought through plan for a holistic way of building a city. The government says it has a plan, and that plan includes earthquake safety, but there's a real lack of transparency in terms of what the actual plans are.
Well, when we come back from a break, I'm going to want to hear more about what you discovered in your reporting in Turkey, Jared, and Professor Chandrasekhar, stand by. We'll hopefully have a chance to talk about what's a better way to both get people into housing after an earthquake, but also rebuild the kind of cities that they want to live in. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be speaking with sociologist Matthew Desmond. He's written a new book called Poverty by America, where he explores the fact that in the richest nation in the world, the United States, there is so much poverty here. So we want to hear from you and your stories and your experiences. Do you feel like, you know, even if you work full time or multiple jobs, that you're still struggling to cover the costs of your family's basic needs? Do you live technically under the poverty line? What is life like for you? Do you live technically above what the federal government sees as the poverty level? And we want to hear about your feelings about how it's like, how challenging it is to make ends meet. So share your experience by recording a message on our On Point Vox Pop app. You can just search for it if you don't already have it. Wherever you get your app, search for On Point Vox Pop. You can also leave us a voicemail if you want at 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the promise that the Turkish president has made to the people of Turkey to quickly rebuild his nation, particularly the southeastern corner of Turkey, following the devastating earthquake that happened there last month. Jared Malson with The Wall Street Journal, let me ask you a question, because I want to keep getting the Turkish context in here. You've spoke with several people in the region, engineers, planners, et cetera. One of them was the head of the Chamber of Civil Engineers in Gaziantep. And he said to you, after all the past earthquakes, we didn't learn our lessons. It's a systemic problem. What was he talking about?
Right. The problem is what you pointed to before, which is that, you know, this is a country that has this kind of generational trauma from the 1999 earthquake, which destroyed part of Istanbul, part of the western part of the country. And then this current government, the AKP government, swept into power in the aftermath of that earthquake, promising to rebuild. And they had 20 years to get the country ready for the next big earthquake. And what the whole country is wrestling with right now is, did this government make decisions that actually made things worse? And what a lot of architects, local officials, and people who survived the earthquake are telling us is that they made choices that actually made these buildings unsafe in a lot of cases, that choices were made about where to build that were unsafe. There was the collapse of public infrastructure, like the airport in the province of Hatay that was severely damaged in the earthquake. So like knocking out the airport to the worst hit province of the country during the earthquake, meaning that people couldn't fly in, rescue workers couldn't fly in to help. So there's just a lot of questions for this government right now in terms of those specific policy decisions over the last 20 years. And so that's what he means by we're repeating those mistakes.
Professor Chandrasekhar, what other problems do you see or concerns do you have with Turkey's rebuilding efforts both in the past and what they're doing now? Because it sounds like from what Jared's saying, some of the mistakes may be being repeated as we speak.
Well, indeed. I mean, every time I read a news article on Turkey, I just keep thinking, wow, this is exactly 1999 all over again. I actually don't see pretty much any difference. Speed of, you know, clearing out and trying to get reconstruction done. This is exactly what they said they wanted to do last time. In the meantime, there have been research papers on this, but also in news, they've talked about the privatization of building inspection, which is, to me, remarkable. But also not, because there was a similar legislation in Utah for this, which was vetoed down. But there was the privatization of that in the sense that instead of having to go to your local government to get your building inspected, you could hire a private inspector to get your building inspected. You know, that sounds great if you are focusing on the speed of development. You want your buildings constructed faster. But private companies don't have the same public good mandate as public agencies do. And so there was a fair number of poor practices, gray areas that crept up because of the privatization of that. That has also led to some of this. And then there was that mass pardoning of building violations, which is also remarkable given the history and the risk of earthquakes in this region. I understand the political reasons for doing that, but it has not worked in the favor of Turkey.
So, you know, we've been focusing on physical reconstruction, right, of actual buildings. But Jared's reporting has this really interesting insight from a man named Osman Akaslan, who's the municipal urban planner in Gaziantep in Turkey. And he told Jared, what they're trying to do is show that we came out of the destruction quickly. Let's build new towns quickly. But in urban planning, speed is something that's not preferred because cities are living organisms. So Professor Chandrasekhar, I'm wondering if you could comment on that, because you can put up a lot of buildings, but a community is much more than just, you know, the wood or concrete blocks that people live in. How does a plan incorporate the other things that are needed to make a livable, vibrant community?
Well, I think the best way to think about it is to think about it in terms of your own life. If you enjoy the places you live in, you want to ask yourself, what are all the things I enjoy about this place? And usually the building is one of many things, right? It is usually my house, the way it's constructed, but also where it's located, its relationships to all the places I like to go to, all the services I like to have, you know, all the people I want to visit, the connection to in the natural environment, you know, the connection to other people, other infrastructures. Maybe you like living near transit stations. So once you start thinking in this way, you understand the complexity of what makes an urban life possible, right? And that means that cities are systems of systems. They are infrastructure systems that intersect and are interdependent, and they connect with each other. And so rebuilding or building a city, even if you're talking about just normal planning, requires consideration of these systems that are in place in an urban area and how they might intersect and how they might be interdependent, and to make decisions that are thoughtful and deliberative about how these systems should be expanded, maintained, maybe reduced, you know, to match the aspirations and the goals of the community. So if rebuilding is a development process, because after all it is, right? If Rome was not built in a day, Rome is not going to be rebuilt in a day. So if you're trying to build your Rome, you have to, or rebuild your Rome, you have to think about the same systems, and you have to give yourself the bandwidth to think about all of these systems in place.
aren't we asking something impossible of governments, whether national or city governments? Because you're exactly right. Rome wasn't built in a day. Neither was any like great city that people want to live in. And in the aftermath of an earthquake, all, as we've said multiple times, all officials can see is the pain that the people are going through and dust, rubble, and devastation as far as the eye can see. The idea that there would be a plan in existence that could help create a livable city that's completely tailored to the region's communities, that seems to be asking something that is impossible for governments to do. We can't even get cities right now that are still, that have been, you know, where they're standing for 200 or 300 years in the United States.
Well, yes, but, you know, I think that the assumption there is that it is the government's job to do it all.
Okay.
And I think the answer is that it is not. And that when you include local populations, when you include local governments, you include all the other people that exist in communities like nonprofits and community-based organizations. When you do this together, it sounds a lot less daunting because the work is a lot more distributed. You know, the priorities are better to understand. There is more potential for consensus in some places or to address contestations in other spots. You know, the fact is that just like development, recovery is also going to be a complex process. Mm-hmm. In some sense, embracing the complexity and working through the complexity is probably the more effective way to successful recovery.
Mm. Well, Jared, I'd love to hear what your reporting from Southeast Turkey tells you about what's happening there now, because you, for example, you quote the head of Turkey's Chamber of Urban Planners, so I guess a national level person who says this isn't planning a city, it's just choosing a location for residential units in a certain area right now. But for those planners and community leaders on the ground in southeastern Turkey, how much do they feel that, you know, as the professor was saying, they're part of the process here?
Right. It's a great question because they aren't. I mean, as I said, the official decree for this reconstruction plan says that even the urban planners within the ministry in Ankara that's doing all of this, they don't have to be involved in the process. And the reason for that is speed. And the government's rationale here, again, is that what they'll say is that they've put this process in the hands of the National Housing Authority, which, to be fair, has an excellent record for earthquake safety. Again, the problem is what that gentleman from the Urban Planners Guild said, which is that, you know, planning has all of these other aspects to it. And it's not just about quality of life. These are also safety concerns, mm-hmm. Because, you know, earthquake safety also means you need ingress and exits, you need gathering places, you need communications infrastructure. And this is what happened in the earthquake in February in places like Antakya, which is a regional capital of about 400,000 people down in Hatay province. The communications towers collapsed, so there was no cell phone service, which was a huge problem when you had thousands of people who needed rescuing from under the rubble. You had thousands of rescuers all jamming their way onto one highway, trying to get there and trying to communicate with one another. So these are all also concerns in the event that there is another earthquake.
Yeah. Professor Chandrasekhar, you know, I was just thinking about the language I've been using throughout this conversation. I keep saying in the aftermath of an earthquake, right? But from what you're saying, obviously, the best management of an aftermath has to actually happen before the earthquake, right? The work that it needs to be undertaken before the disaster to do things like engage the community, find out what desires for what life would be like, what their needs are, etc. Let's move our focus away from Turkey right now, because clearly from Jared's reporting, that hasn't really happened. There's a lot of earthquake-prone zones in the United States. Are we seeing that kind of pre-planning being done here?
Well, you know, pre-planning is planning done in two ways. One is thinking about recovery before the recovery has happened. So we call that pre-planning, you know, or pre-disaster recovery planning, right? This is when you create recovery frameworks before for an anticipated event. You might say, well, if I do have this event, what are the various institutional infrastructures that will kick into place? Understanding that we will not know exactly what the recovery needs will be until the event has happened. But at least we can prepare our institutional, you know, structures and institutions to respond to the long-term recovery process.
Are they ready to do that? Because you're in Salt Lake City, for example, right?
I wish I could say that they were.
Does Salt Lake have a plan?
Well, Salt Lake County has a recovery framework. I'm not sure to what extent it is actually still active. The Utah state has a recovery framework, which I think they're trying to update soon. But it's not common to have a pre-disaster recovery framework. And they're called frameworks because you cannot have a plan because you don't know the exact impact. But the framework is a very important thing. And there was a time, I would say about a decade ago, where there was more of a move to do these. And I think Florida was requiring some of their communities to do this because of the, you know, multiple repetitive events that they had had, loss events that they had had with hurricanes. But somehow it sort of faded into insignificance. I'm not sure why. It's a very remarkable tool that we should be doing more of.
Well, I understand that you have a student that asked, for example, public housing authorities in the Salt Lake region if they had planned for a big earthquake and what their recovery process would be, and what was their answer?
Well, they haven't thought about it. I could have anticipated that answer even without talking to them. Pre-planning for recovery requires funding. You know, it requires like a budget line, which is not the same as maintaining your properties or doing planning for your needs now. And so a lot of organizations tend to struggle with just funding, resources, even knowledge. You know, how do I do this? Or just what is my risk, right? Am I exposed to earthquakes? Am I exposed to hurricanes? That kind of risk analysis also hasn't been done. So in Utah, when we spoke with public housing agencies, we asked them, look, you know, public housing residents are specifically vulnerable. We know this from a lot of research. Recovery tends to hit them really hard. They're also dependent on the government for housing. It's not like they can just go build a house wherever they like, right? So have you thought about where these people will eventually settle, or how you will recover the housing that you do have? And the answer, of course, was no. It doesn't mean that they don't understand the importance of it. When they think about it, it's really important to them. But they have constraints of resources and technical know-how.
Yeah.
And that's a common problem.
Well, Divya Chandrasekhar is an associate professor of city and metropolitan planning at the University of Utah. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Jared Malson, Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, based in Istanbul. His reporting on the aftermath of the massive Turkish earthquake has been terrific, and we have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Jared, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.